Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 23rd annual Yom HaShoah Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration takes place next Thursday in a Zoom virtual setting. Each year, the Tulsa Council for Holocaust Education highlights a different aspect of this horrific event in our history. Past themes have included those who gave shelter, who saved lives, the children of the Holocaust, the rescuers, and those who resisted. This year, the committee reflected on a quote by Elie Wiesel, who once said, "The question is not why all Jews did not fight, but how so many of them did." And this year's keynote speaker is the outreach director for the Jewish Partisan Educational Foundation that captures the histories and passes on the stories of the estimated 30,000 Jewish partisans that fought the Germans during the war in locations throughout Europe. Sherry Rosenblum will share some of the stories of the estimated 3,000 of those partisans who were female. She'll speak on Choosing to Act, Jewish Women's Resistance in the Holocaust, as a part of the commemoration, Thursday evening, April 22nd at 7 o'clock, via Zoom. You can request a Zoom link by calling the Jewish Federation of Tulsa at 918-495-1100. Sherry Rosenblum is my guest today. Sherry Rosenblum, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
That's my pleasure.
Your organization has collected the story of many of the surviving 30,000 Jewish partisans that were active during World War II. Why is it important to tell these particular stories?
Well, there's been a myth over many years, really since the Holocaust, that the Jews were passive and did not fight back during the Holocaust and that they went like sheep to the slaughter. And that's simply untrue. And I think that the myth of this passivity is really a detriment to telling the accurate history of the Holocaust. And it portrays the Jewish people in a light that is really, truly unfair. And when you think about it, Jews resisted in every way that they possibly could, through spiritual resistance, through humor, through music, every way that they could, even in the concentration camps. And there are so many incidents of Jewish resistance. And I think one of the ways that you can really see this highlighted is in a quote by Elie Wiesel, where he talks about the fact that it's not why didn't the Jews fight back, but how is it that so many of them did, beaten, starved, demoralized? Where did they find the strength, both physical and spiritual, to resist in the many, many ways that they did? And so it's really important to highlight all aspects of Jewish resistance. And the Jewish partisans in particular was really until our organization came into existence in 2000 was really a hidden history. Very, very few people knew that Jews fought back in armed resistance against the Nazis and their collaborators. And I want to say that it really was a last resort, that this was not something that Jews did at the very beginning when the Nazis were coming to power, but it was a last resort when the only option was that they were being slaughtered by the millions and they had to fight back to save their lives, to save the lives of other Jews. And this is what they did. And it's really important for the world to know and to have an accurate picture of the history of the Holocaust.
Yeah, that last resort also gives lie to the thought that nobody knew what was happening in the lead up to the final solution as well. I mean, Jews were very aware of what's happening. Well, I want to talk about that myth of passivity that you talked about. Why and how did that myth take hold?
Well, I don't know how that myth took hold, but I think that one of the things, you know, when we talk about the frog in the boiling water, you know, the Nazis were really masterful in their propaganda machine. And when you think about it, when you put a frog in a pot of water and it's room temperature, the frog is going to be very complacent. They're not going to know that there's anything going on. And then as you slowly turn the temperature up, it becomes a little bit uncomfortable. And then when the water, by the time the water's boiling, it's too late for that frog to jump out of the pot. And that was very, very similar to the situation of the Jews, that first of all, how they didn't know what was going on at the beginning. And by the time that they did, it was really too late in many instances to do anything about it. And it was just really the incredulity of what was happening to think that a group of people, the Nazis, could do what they were doing to another people. When you think about it, even now, all these years later, that a country and an army could murder 6 million people systematically. I mean, it's mind-boggling. I mean, I think about it. I was just saying to my mother the other day, she was rewatching our own Yom HaShoah commemoration, and she too has been a scholar of the Holocaust. And she said to me, you know, she sits here years and years later, of course, she was a child at the time, and she looks back, and even today, we shake our heads and we say, how could this have happened? It's still all these years later, we know it happened, and still we shake our heads in disbelief that this could happen. So you imagine at the time that they weren't passive, that they were just shocked and stunned. And as this was happening, nobody wants to believe that it's happening and that your whole way of life is being disrupted. I mean, when you think about what was going on in Germany, for example, that it happened so slowly with the Nuremberg laws, that one day maybe you're a professor at a university and the first thing that happens to you is that you're relieved of your position and you think, okay, I'll find another job, or things have got to get better, and they don't. They start getting worse and worse and worse. And, you know, next thing you know, your child can't go to school with other children. And then you can't buy groceries at a certain store. Then you can't buy food at all. Yeah. And it just was step by step by step.
And you lose the wherewithal and the ability to remove yourself from that situation. If you don't have a job, right, you don't have the money to leave.
Yeah. Exactly. It wasn't like they did it overnight, that one day, you know, it was, they chipped away at it bit by bit by bit.
Well, you talked about the hidden history that your organization has tried to publicize. Of course, one story of Jewish partisans has become more known through the film Defiance about the Bielski partisans, but that was far from the only all-Jewish partisan group. How extensive were Jewish partisans during the war?
Well, there were many, many, many Jewish partisans, but many of them fought with non-Jewish partisan groups, and there were, that was more the norm. Because while there were many all-Jewish partisan groups, there were certainly many, many more non-Jewish partisan groups. So it was more the norm that Jews were fighting with partisan groups that were not Jewish. And certainly there were Jewish partisans that fought with partisan groups in Western Europe, in Greece, Italy, France. And in those areas, those partisan groups tended to be friendly to Jews and tended to accept them readily, and those relationships tended to be positive ones. In Eastern Europe, where there had been century-long history of anti-Semitism, it was much more difficult, and particularly, you know, in Eastern Europe and in Russia, where many of the partisan groups there were made up of former Soviet POWs. So, of course, when Hitler decided to turn on Stalin, and many of the partisan groups were Red Army soldiers who immediately lost their uniforms, kept their arms, became partisans, or were POWs. They had a history of anti-Semitism. They were not keen on accepting Jews into their ranks. And so many Jews who joined those partisan groups hid the fact that they were Jewish. They would not have been accepted into those groups if they had, if it was known that they were Jewish. So they had to hide their identities. And even many of those partisan groups, those non-Jewish partisan groups, were so anti-Semitic that they turned Jewish partisans over to the Nazis and their collaborators, and in some instances murdered Jewish partisans themselves, would steal their guns and then use those same guns to kill them themselves. Wow. So there was quite a lot of anti-Semitism in the Polish Home Army. We actually just finished commissioning an article that we're going to be soon publishing on our website that talks about that, how there was a really a mixed bag in the Polish Home Army between groups that were tolerable of the Jewish partisans and groups that were outwardly anti-Semitic. So one of the people I speak about in the talk that I'm giving on the 22nd was a female Jewish partisan named Faye Shulman, who was a photographer. She is thought to be the only known Jewish partisan photographer. She was a young woman. She was about 19 years old when she was one of the only people left alive in her village of Lenin. There was a massacre there. She was kept alive so that she could develop the photographs of the massacre. And they kept her alive to do all this photography and this development, but they soon brought in somebody from their ranks that they were having her train to do all of this work. And so she was a smart girl. She read the writing on the wall, which meant that she was training her replacement. And as soon as that replacement was trained, she was going to end up being murdered. And so one night she snuck out into the woods and took her camera with her. She ended up with an all-male, all-Russian partisan group. And she never, ever, ever let them know the entire time she was with them that she was Jewish, because it was already a strike against her that she was a woman. But they accepted her into the group because for two reasons. One was that her brother had been a doctor, so she passed herself off as having some rudimentary knowledge of medicine, which probably meant she knew how to put on a Band-Aid. So she became the group's medic, and because she had this camera, and her Russian commander of the group had an ego, and he wanted her to document every single victory, every single excursion that they did. So she was there as the documentary photographer, taking photographs and developing them. And so she has basically chronicled the partisan history of her group, which is really, truly amazing that you have these photographs that she took. And there is, you know, a cache of surviving prints that she developed by firelight under blankets. And we have a collection that actually travels the world of her photographs. She's still living. She's 101.
Wow.
She lives in Toronto, Canada. But, you know, she lived in fear the entire time that she would be discovered as a Jew, and didn't know what that would mean, what the repercussions might be if she was discovered as a Jew, whether she would be simply cast out from her group and with no protection in the woods, or whether she might be punished severely, even perhaps murdered, because of her deception. She was with the group for about 2 years until the war ended without ever being discovered. But it was something that she lived in fear of the entire time. So, you know, really interesting situations like that for people. But yes, you know, there were definitely all Jewish partisan groups, primarily in Eastern Europe, although there was a all Jewish, all female partisan group in Greece that was led by a woman named Sarah Fortas, who also is still living in Israel. And they were highly respected, highly successful. They fought alongside the Andartes in Greece, and they had an affectionate name for her. They called her Kapitana Sarika. So you hear some of these stories, but certainly the Belskis are the most well-known. They were the largest all-Jewish partisan group, and they are known for the fact that they accepted everybody into their group. So they didn't just have fighters, but they accepted men, women, children, the elderly, and they formed what was an entire village in the woods. That village moved several times because it was discovered. But, you know, Tuvia Belsky, who was the leader of that group, along with his brothers, had his philosophy was that he would rather save one old Jewish woman than kill 10 Nazis. His was really about preserving life and saving Jews, and he really operated under the motto of the Jewish philosopher Hillel, which was, if I'm only for myself, who will be for me? If I am only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when?
My guest today is Sherry Rosenblum, a director of development and outreach for the Jewish Partisan Educational Foundation, and she'll be the keynote speaker virtually for the 23rd annual Yom HaShoah Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration, Thursday, April 22nd at 7 o'clock. That'll be on Zoom. And she'll be speaking on a subset of the Jewish partisans choosing to act Jewish women's resistance in the Holocaust. And I imagine you're going to talk about that all-female brigade in Greece and Sarah Fortas. You know, what were the roles of women partisans? I would assume some of them were doing what were domestic activities, cooking, cleaning, caring for the men, you know, cleaning uniforms and or clothes and things like that. But they did a whole variety of roles, just like the woman you talked about who was the documenter of that partisan group. What were some of the roles?
Yes, they did do a wide variety of roles. And, you know, it's interesting because when you're thinking about these women, remember that most of these women were teenagers when they came to these groups, and most of them had come from what we would describe today as, you know, middle-class families, so to speak, meaning that they did not lead hard scrabble lives living up to the time when the Nazis marched into their villages. You know, they lived with their families. They were going to school, whether it was a religious school or a public school of some sort. You know, maybe they took piano lessons or dance lessons or belonged to a different club. But, you know, with one exception, which you'll see in our film, none of them describe themselves as being particularly outdoorsy. In our full-length documentary, Every Day the Impossible, Etta Robel talks about how she was the girl that rode the bicycle and wore shorts, and she was always a fighter. But she's really the exception. Most of them were pretty mild-mannered, and now they find themselves in this unique situation. So a lot of them did serve as medics. Some of them worked around the camp doing different kinds of duties, preparing food, doing laundry. You know, in the case of the Belfties, where they had this entire village, there were a lot of different activities that they could be doing in terms of cooking, laundry, that sort of thing. And that was no easy feat. You know, for example, food was not plentiful. So, you know, Sonia Orbach, who is one of the partisans on our website, talks about how she had 2 hours she was also a medic, mind you, but she, on the days that she was at the campsite, she'd have 2 hours to cook, clean the campsite, and prepare food for the entire group. And she might have to prepare a meal for 25 people using 10 potatoes and whatever else she could find, which was not an easy feat. A lot of the women did go out on sabotage missions. Gertie Boyarsky, also in that film, talks about how on International Women's Day, which at the time was a Soviet holiday, she and another woman in her group were responsible for blowing up a German transport bridge that was taking supplies to the front. It was used to take supplies to the front, so it was rearming the German army. It was a really critical bridge. And she and her colleague went into the village and they demanded straw and kerosene. And the village told them, we don't have straw and kerosene. And they told the village people, give us straw and kerosene right now or we're going to kill you. And so they gave them straw and kerosene and they went and they lit the bridge on fire. And the Germans saw them doing it and caught them in their crosshairs and were firing at them, but they managed to escape and without being shot, and they burn down the bridge. So you've got things that are pretty extreme ends of the duties, but every one of them equally important. Really many, many different roles that women played. There are pictures we have of women operating printing presses, where they got them and how they had these partisan newsletters that they would send out from partisan group to partisan group in the forest. Who knows? But they had printing presses that they were operating in the forest. I mean, they were extremely resourceful.
Yeah. One of the interesting things for women, it's you know, if, even for Jewish partisans, you talked about if they were in a non-all-Jewish unit, they had to worry about whether they would be killed themselves, or they also ran the risk of greater possible identification from villagers and betrayal that way. But for the women, it was also, you had sexism. And,
exactly.
And the fact that within the group, they may be subject to sexual assault, and many were within their partisan group.
Yes, that absolutely was true. You know, rape was a really big issue. There was a lot of pressure on women to take what they called a forest husband. In some instances, I would say not many, but most instances, these women came to these groups orphaned. You know, they had lost every single person in their family. And they were desperate to belong to a group, and they had nothing. They would come. They didn't have a gun with them. They were desperate to belong. In some instances, that was the currency that they could barter for the protection of being in a group. And they felt like they had no other option. And it was better to take a forest husband in some instances and have the protection of maybe one officer than being at the mercy of potentially being raped by multiple people. It also maybe gave them access to having better clothing or better food rations if the men went on missions to secure food and clothing and that sort of thing. You know, there's a story that Sonia Orbach, who happened to be with her family, her entire family was accepted into an all-Russian unit because her uncle was a scout and knew the forest very, very well. And that was an asset to the Russian partisan unit. They really needed his skill. So although this family came with no guns or anything else, they had an asset. And this Russian unit accepted them. They were, I wouldn't say they were friendly to Jews, but they were neutral. Let's just put it that way.
They had a common foe.
They had a common foe, and Sonia's name at the time was Sarah. They were concerned that if any other Russian group came upon them, there would be repercussions because they had a Jew in their midst, so they had her change her name from Sarah to Sonia, which she never changed her entire life. She remained Sonia throughout her entire life. But she was pressured as soon as she got to the group. She was 17 years old. The commander's wife called her in and suggested to her that she take an officer as a boyfriend, that things would go much easier for her. She, of course, refused. But then again, she also had both of her parents there and her uncle as protection. And even at that, because she refused, initially there were some repercussions towards her family that eventually, you know, eventually passed. But that was something that was very real. That was less frequent, of course, among the Jewish groups. They tried to be very self-policing about that, but I can't guarantee or say for certain that that didn't happen in Jewish groups as well. But that was an issue. You know, the women had, you know, in a Russian group, they had a lot of strikes against them that they had to really fight against, you know, being Jewish, number one, and being a woman, number two. It was really a challenge for them. And a lot of women just simply never spoke about it after the war.
Your organization has publicized some of these female Jewish partisans like Etta Robel and Brenda Senders and many others. And at least a few of them were actually in combat. How rare was that?
You know, we have actually a lot. We have a secondary website too, jewishpartisancommunity.org, that we started in 2017, which is simply biographies that we have worked with families on over the last 3.5 years. We have about 30 biographies on that site that are just women. Mm-hmm. And most of the women on that site were involved in combat, blowing up bridges. We have a story of a woman named Sarah Rosnow who went out. She insisted on going with this group of men to blow up a bridge. It was a pouring rain. Everybody's dynamite was soaked to nearly saturated, as were their matches. and they were all pretty much ready to give up, thinking it was going to be an impossible task. And she insisted on doing it, and she climbed to the top of the bridge, and she succeeded in getting her dynamite lit, and she was the one that blew up the bridge.
Hmm. Has your organization found that perhaps more women were involved in actual instances of sabotage and combat than perhaps we previously thought from your oral histories and compiling these histories?
I think so. I think that we're finding that there are more women that went on sabotage missions than maybe we initially knew. I think perhaps as we were delving more into it and finding more people, that we were finding more in their stories that they were involved in sabotage. I wouldn't say that they were involved in using guns on the battlefield, but definitely in sabotaging and blowing up train tracks and blowing up bridges and that sort of thing. Mm. They certainly were not afraid to risk their lives. Sonia Orbach, you know, even as a medic, you know, there she was on the field tending to the wounded, and she recounts a story where she's on the battlefield and there are bullets literally whizzing by her head. And she says, "I didn't even duck down. I wasn't afraid to die. If I was going to die, I was going to die as a fighter, and not because I was a Jew."
Dying as a fighter instead of dying as a Jew. How prevalent was that in most of these women that your organization has interviewed and gotten to know?
I think it's very prevalent. I think that everybody was either fighting to save lives, fighting for revenge, or fighting back. They're fighting back against the Nazis. They were not going to be victims. That was absolutely a tremendous motivator. They felt like they had nothing to lose. I mean, Gertie Boyarski, who's the one that blew up the bridge that I mentioned, she said, I felt like I had nothing to lose. There was nothing to lose. You know, she'd already lost her entire family. You know, they took every single day, one day at a time. They're fighting for the future, and at that point, they had nothing to lose.
You can hear more about some of these stories Thursday, April 22nd at the 23rd Annual Yom HaShoah Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration. Sherry, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Sherry Rosenblum is the Director of Development and Outreach for the Jewish Partisan Educational Foundation. She'll be the keynote speaker for the 23rd Annual Yom HaShoah Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration, which will take place next Thursday, April 22nd at 7 o'clock via Zoom. You can request a Zoom link by calling the Jewish Federation of Tulsa at 918-495-1100. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.